This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on the largest sex discrimination lawsuit in history against the country's largest employer, a class action suit on behalf of 1.5 million female employees at Walmart claims rampant bias in both pay and promotion. Walmart rejects the charges. The case before the Supreme Court focuses really on a separate issue, the unprecedented size of the class in this suit. But along the way, the justices heard a lot about sex discrimination in the workplace, and some have begun to suggest that we should declare the long fight over equal pay for equal work over. More on the court case in just a moment. But what is happening where you work? Have we reached the tipping point on sex discrimination? Our phone number, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, the second in our series of conversations on ideas to reduce the federal debt. But first, NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you with us, Nina, as always.
Nice to be here, Neil.
And again, this case before the court, not about sex discrimination per se, but about the unprecedented number of people in a class action suit.
It's even actually broader than that. The district court in this case, let's just say for a minute what a class action is. Mm-hmm. It's when a whole group of people get together and sue in a single lawsuit on behalf of everybody in a similar situation. In products, you sue for a bad product and everybody gets some money back, for example. Well, you do the same thing in employment discrimination. And there have been very large employment discrimination lawsuits in the past, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of people, but not one this big. And Walmart has 3,400 stores. And it says, you know, countless different categories of people, and you can't mush them all together, that a class action suit has to have commonality, that people really have to be in the same situation. On the other side, the lawyers for the plaintiffs say, look, these are cookie-cutter jobs. They're basically five different kinds of jobs all the way up the line. And Walmart both controls everything from headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, and gives local managers too much discretion, and that the end result is that there's a big pay gap and a big promotion gap.
And so along the way, that's the issue that's going to be decided eventually by the court when they come around, probably in, what, June. But in any case, along the way, there were some really interesting arguments in this case about sex discrimination.
Well, it was, you know, a little bit of a litmus test. I should say here that it is entirely possible that the court will be unanimous and reach some fairly limited conclusion and send this case back to the lower court and say, you didn't do this right. You've got to revisit all kinds of questions. Or it could be much more limited than that. It could be much more divided than that. It could be 5-4. But what was interesting is this, you know, we now have three female justices.
For the first time.
For the first time. And they clearly rejected Walmart's argument that you needed something more specific to show discrimination.
Other than results.
And the plaintiffs say there's unfettered discretion, and that's the practice that leads to discrimination. And Walmart says that's not enough. You have to show a policy. And the three women said, if you give people unfettered discretion, there is plenty of evidence that there can be discrimination. And Justice Ginsburg said that, she who began her career pioneering in sex discrimination cases and was a plaintiff in a class action suit against her employer. And Justice Kagan, who is, you know, a quarter century younger and was the first female dean at Harvard Law School, she said that. And Justice Sotomayor said that, and they said that quite aggressively. And so it was interesting to watch it play out. I mean, there was a great moment when Justice Ginsburg said, you know, there was a case here a while ago from AT&T. Women said they weren't being promoted to middle management positions, and they did just as well as the men on all the tests, but they flunked the whole person test, which was the subjective test, mm-hmm. Which was, and that was the guys looking at the gals and saying, well, she's not her whole person rating isn't good enough.
Well, what do you mean by whole person rating?
And I think I've screwed up the name. It was some, or their personhood rating. Let me find where this place is in my notes. Justice Ginsburg said, noted that the women scored competitively for promotion on the objective tests, but disproportionately flunked the final and subjective total person test.
Okay.
Largely because, all other things being equal, decision makers tend to pick people who look and sound like themselves, and that was women. And the women won that case.
So in getting back to the Walmart case, what they're suggesting by supervisors on the local level getting too much discretion, in other words, they got to hire whomever pretty much they wanted to hire, and they could use subjective criterion.
And Walmart counters, we have a very strong anti-discrimination policy. We've done the best we can. We train people out of Bentonville, Arkansas. All our managers have to go through that. And the other side says, yeah, but you don't really supervise them. And they point, for example, to one of the top managers who said, diversity is fine, but unless you actually reward people for diversity and punish them when they have disproportionate workforces, it doesn't mean anything. It's just lip service. And at the court, we saw some of the conservatives, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, saying, well, Walmart's numbers, as I understand it, aren't any different than society's numbers in general, to which the lawyers for the plaintiffs said, well, but what counts is the numbers in this particular company. Otherwise, you just will always repeat those numbers.
They will be perpetuated forever. And indeed, if you fail to promote women, then you don't have enough women supervisors to maybe hire people on the total person score like them. And so you perpetuate the problem there.
Walmart, interestingly, brought out its one of its very senior executives, its head of HR, vice president for HR, Giselle Rees, to in front of cameras to make the case for Walmart's diversity program.
And it's interesting. From what you said, it might sound like the justices were tough on Walmart. Later in the case, when the plaintiffs...
They were much tougher on the plaintiffs. Yeah. And in fact, the women piled on the plaintiffs, too. And they said, look, you say there are no records on these promotions. And that you say it's too late now to have individualized hearings for who gets back pay. Justice Ginsburg said, this is a very serious problem. How can you handle 1.5 million people to determine who gets what to prevent some from getting a windfall and others from being disproportionately harmed and not getting their just reward?
And so it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. As you said, it might be a unanimous decision on a narrow issue sending it. We simply don't know. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We're going to be talking about the workforce in general, not just Walmart, but is sex discrimination over? Have women reached the tipping point in the long fight over equal pay for equal work?
I think we should stress here that this is not a case at this point about whether Walmart discriminated or not. It is whether this case can go to trial before a jury. And a federal district court judge, after lengthy hearings, said there was enough commonality here that they could proceed. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed by a very close vote, and then the Supreme Court agreed to review the case. And I really think that, in candor, when the Supreme Court agreed to review the case, that was a signal that this case is not going to go forward, at least as is. The question is, how, if at all, will it be allowed to go forward?
And before we go forward, Nina, I wanted to ask you, as you look at the legal profession, for one profession, has the number of women in that profession changed substantially over the years, and does it represent something like equality now?
It has changed very substantially. About half the students graduating from law school are women. The same is true in the medical profession. But there are still a lot, there still is significant disproportionality if you look at the big partners in law firms. There's relatively a fewer number of those are women compared to in other professions. But actually, interestingly, I just wrote a speech about this for a medical group for the American College of Surgeons. And it was interesting to find that in some ways medicine does better than some other professions because, at least in surgery, it's piecework. You get paid for what you do. If you want to take time off, you get paid for fewer pieceworks, so to speak. I mean, that's very oversimplistic, obviously. Yeah. I'm not going to redo my speech here, but it's...
Well, you make it sound like the ILGWU here for a minute.
but there is no doubt that there still is some forms of very subtle discrimination, some less subtle. There's also no doubt that women have a different approach often, not all the time, but often to their work life. They still are more often the primary caregivers for their children, that they, in general, may want to work fewer hours, and that society imposes some interesting things on them. Justice Ginsburg tells a wonderful story about when her son was a kid, and it was, as she puts it, active. And she kept getting called from the principal of the school because he was in trouble again, and she was getting these calls. And one day, she was pulling her hair out. She was a lawyer. She had cases all over the place. She had a case in the Supreme Court. And she finally said to the principal, "This child has two parents, you know. Try the other one." And once they realized they had to call every other time, they at least had to call the father, they called less.
Nina Totenberg, as always, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg with us here in Studio 3A. We're talking about sex discrimination in the workplace. Is the battle for equality over? Up next, we'll look at evidence on both sides of progress and where problems continue. What has happened where you work? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. In recent years, women have reduced the pay gap with men, but not entirely. And this at a time where more women than men graduate from college and more women work outside the home. There are some who argue the battle for equality in the workplace has been won, and they explain the remaining pay gap with other factors. Others argue the experience of countless women proves there's still a long way to go. What's happened where you work? Have we reached the tipping point on sex discrimination? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Eileen Lang is president and CEO of Catalyst Incorporated, a nonprofit organization that researches the status of women in the workplace. And she joins us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And your company focuses much of its research on women in relatively high-level positions. What are the trends there?
Well, we have been studying the representation of women in senior levels of Fortune 500 companies, which are the largest companies that are headquartered in the U.S., although they happen to be global companies. We've been doing this for over 15 years, and we count. We do a census every year, so we look to see how many women are on boards of directors and how many women hold senior positions like CEO and other executive-level positions. And what we've seen over these years is that women have been 46 to 49% of the overall workforce in the U.S. They have been 50% of managers and professional positions in the workforce. But when it comes to the senior levels, we've been stuck at about 15%.
15%?
Yeah. Now, in 1995, when we started, it was around 9%. And by 2004, it was up to about 15%. It's fluctuated, but not statistically significant ways. And it's stuck around 15% of women held board seats and women in executive positions. And I would say, just to emphasize, those are averages. So in some companies, it's zero, and in some companies, it's as high as 50% or more, but the average has been stuck.
And
these are 500 companies, Fortune 500.
But that's an elite level of employment. Surely it's not the same for women throughout the workforce.
Well, actually, that's what we all thought. And we thought that until about 8 years ago when we, or 5 years, 5 to 8 years ago when we saw that there was this leveling off. And we said, what's causing this? Could there be a problem in the pipeline? That's what we call the middle manager and next level of director, but people coming up into leadership across companies. So we've been studying that for the last 4 years, and we've had some very interesting results. We looked at alums, women and men, close to 5,000 of them from around the world who had earned MBA degrees at 26 of the most prestigious programs in the U.S., Canada, Europe, and Asia. And we actually plotted career paths. We looked at their first job up to their current job over a period of many years. And we looked at their work experience before they went to get their MBA. We looked at the function, the industry, the geography. Afterwards, we looked at everything. We looked at parenthood status. So we even compared women with no children to men with no children. And what we found was that there was a pay gap from the very first job after business school, only based on being a woman.
We're talking about sex discrimination in the workplace. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Let's start with Frida. Frida with us from New Mexico.
Hello.
Hi, Frida. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to relate. I've been a federal employee with the U.S. Forest Service for more than 30 years, originally as a seasonal and then as a permanent. Back in the late 70s, I experienced threats of physical harm in my job. I was in wildland fire and land management.
Mm-hmm.
And it got better through the early to mid-80s, and then it's actually in the last 7-8 years, it's as bad as it was in the 70s.
Really?
It's not about the policy, because the policies are clearly in place. It's the federal workplace, but there is no accountability. And when, you know, we're looking now at new furlough, the possibility of furloughs, those people in those jobs are all about safety and security. And I've worked in 5 different states. The discrimination also had a racial bias when I was in the northern tiered states, and I'm in New Mexico now, in part to get away from that. I can't change the fact that I'm female, but I can at least change the fact that I don't stand out as much racially. But it's clearly, I mean, I have physical threats and threats of violence with firearms and even bringing physical proof to law enforcement agents within the agency. And generally having them tell me it's time to move on.
Time to move, in other words, to leave.
Yeah. They weren't going to bother to deal with it. I've had 3 different mediators come in from the outside, not specifically on my case, but when they were talking to our forest teams in general, say, you know, you're wasting your time here. They don't have to change. They're not going to change. You need to find a different way. But, you know, at the time I was idealistic and thought, how do you get the system to change if you're not willing to work from within?
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was about performance, and I just set new records for the first person to get outstanding performance appraisals with no monetary or certificate awards. So it's pretty discouraging, and I would not recommend any female relative, friend, or acquaintance to bother with the federal government and the Forest Service. Certainly it's no longer worth the pay either, but all the education you can bring to it and your sincerity, there's too much male dominance. And I've been in a lot of the Western states where specific religious cultures can be dominant too.
Eileen, that's a depressing call, but I thank you for it.
Mm-hmm.
And Eileen Lang, you would think the federal government would be a model, as our caller said. All of the rules are in effect.
Well, it is a depressing call, and I think that it's a huge, you have to remember the government's a huge employer, and there are different kinds of jobs and different situations. And I feel terrible to hear the story that this woman just told.
Here's an email we have from Lisa, and this is a completely different profession. I graduated from medical school in 1982 after 10 years on faculty at one large academic medical center. A committee to investigate gender disparities in salary found problems. I got a 30% raise. 2 years ago, when I was now at a large private medical center, another committee to investigate gender disparities in salary resulted in a 40% raise. Yes, I think there are still problems. Supervisors have told me to my face that since my husband makes a good salary, I don't need to make as much. That's interesting. And this from Whitney in Boise. My friends and I talk about this all the time. We women are treated differently in the workplace. It's probably not as overt as it once was, but often we're not given as many opportunities. We're not paid as much. A recent boss of mine constantly second-guessed my decisions. I guarantee if I were an older man, she wouldn't have questioned me as often. I finally offered to enlarge and post a copy of my resume for her on her wall so she could remember why she hired me, and she backed off. Does it suggest that female employers are no easier than men?
Well, Catalyst Research has got we've gone into all these different kinds of issues that are being raised in these emails and comments that you've just read. Mm-hmm. And our analysis shows that it all is true. It all happens. And it's not necessarily a basis of the gender of the supervisor, because all women and men, we live in the same society and we're subject to the same social norms. So we behave in similar kinds of ways. Our research also shows that as women are rising in the managerial ranks, one of the most important things that they say is critical to them to be successful is to develop a style that men are comfortable with. So if you think about that, what that really means is women are often more successful, or think they're going to be more successful, or are encouraged to think they will be more successful if they behave more like men. So I would venture to say that women and men pretty much manage and lead in ways that the corporate culture encourages and rewards and supports, and that we probably are holding women managers to a higher standard around this whole issue without remembering that we're all subject to similar cultural norms.
Let's go next to Chris, and Chris with us from New Orleans.
Yes, hello. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to basically just provide my experience in the workplace regarding this issue of gender equality. And basically, I work for a woman-owned disadvantaged small business under the 8A program, Small Business Administration. And I feel that primarily the government services and programs that have allowed this organization to succeed and be able to compete in the marketplace because of these disadvantaged recognitions has allowed women to advance towards equality in the workplace. I can say in my organization, most of the leadership roles, not necessarily all, or not necessarily even most, but many at least of the leadership roles are occupied by women. And I would assume, I don't know the salaries of everyone in the company per se, but I can say that, I feel like that is an equalizing factor in a market that otherwise, the gender discrimination would probably continue.
All right.
And as a matter of fact, during the last legislative session, the 111th Congress, there was a Small Business Administration law that was passed which strengthened the Women Disadvantaged Program to especially in the area of the mentor and mentoree roles for different or companies and that sort of thing. And so I think, equality in a diverse society is not something that's just achieved and then you walk away. It's just something that we as a society always have to keep working towards. And I think at least as long as our eye is on that prize, we're heading in that direction.
All right, Chris, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for your time.
Here's an email from Michael in Grand Rapids. As a man in the healthcare world, I'm in meetings with 20 or 30 women sometimes and the only man in the room. Nina Totenberg mentioned it earlier, but I think any time any group has more power and there's not parity, you can get the potential for abuse. Since I have been sexually harassed by women who are my boss, I'd say we are reaching equity in our society. Women are finally equal to men in both their abilities for positive change and negative. Well, I think it's a great change in society, even if it has some negative effects for me personally. We're talking about sex discrimination in the workplace. Have we reached a tipping point? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation. And our guest again is Eileen Lang, President and CEO of Catalyst, a research and advisory organization that focuses on advancing women into business leadership. And I wanted to read you something that was written by Jonah Goldberg recently in a blog, the National Review Online. At a time when education matters more than ever, more American women attend college than men. More women graduate with better grades and get more advanced degrees. Even the fight for pay equity is an argument about statistics, lagging cultural indicators, and the actual choices liberated women make to take time away from paid jobs to raise their kids. Never married women without kids earn more than men, or to work in occupations like the nonprofit sector that pay less. These are the fruits of feminist success. Should we celebrate important feminist success?
Well, I would say that I agree with him up through the point about the statistics about women's education mm-hmm. and educational achievements. But from that point on, it's just what he claims is just not supported by the facts. All of the studies about the gender pay gap control for some of these factors that he talks about. They control for the industry that you're in. They control for whether or not there are children involved. So I think that he's overlooking the basic economic arguments here that suggest that, you know, by blaming the women for making less money than men, it's not a matter of blaming the women. Pay equity is still not in our a reality. Now, that doesn't mean everywhere, but industry by industry, you see broad variations. But at the same time, there is a there still is a core 18% pay gap. That means women earn 82 cents to the every dollar that men earn. Now, those are averages, but that was based on 2010 data for women and men working full time.
Let's go next to Emily. Emily with us from Colorado Springs.
Hi, I was just calling to impart my experience in the corporate world versus nonprofit world. I worked for a large corporate law firm. I'm trained as an attorney and have a master's degree in addition to that. And when it came time for me to look at family life, I thought, oh, maybe I will maybe not continue in that realm and want to go into nonprofit world. And, you know, I think a number of us in the nonprofit community realize that there are just as many issues in the nonprofit world in terms of equity and not just in pay, but wanting flexibility and that kind of thing.
And so what has happened in your situation?
Oh, I mean, I don't want to disparage my employer, but I think that, you know, I think that there are a number of us in the nonprofit world. I seem to think, maybe it's just anecdotally, that there are more women in the nonprofit sphere. So you'd think that there would be more safeguards or more things put in place for that family life adjustment, those flexibility. And unfortunately, it seems like even that corporate culture of the glass ceiling seems to transfer over. And I you know, have a number of friends in the nonprofit world that are struggling with that family life issue right now and wanting it to be different, but not experiencing that the same, even though it seems like that there are just so many more of us in the nonprofit world thinking that that would change. And I don't think it is. It's not just pay equity. It's just lifestyle as well.
All right. Emily, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And good luck. Here's an email. We'll end with this from Susan. Discrimination is a symptom of society. The laws help, but we need teachers and parents to teach both their sons and daughters that we are equal. I'm a female mechanical engineer. The percentage of women in engineering has not increased since the late 1970s. When I asked my company's recruiter why we were not hiring more female engineers, she said none were applying. When I ask a young woman why they aren't becoming engineers, they say they hate science and math. The support needs to start as kids, and then hopefully some days the laws will not be necessary. Well, we wanted to thank Eileen Lang for her time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Eileen Lang is president and CEO of Catalyst, a research and research and advisory organization that focuses on advancing women into business leadership. She joined us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversations about the debt. We're going to talk today with Allison Acosta Frazier, who's with the Economic Policies Studies Program at the Heritage Foundation. Yesterday, we heard from a different organization, tomorrow from another. We're asking you to listen to all three of these. Hold your questions until Thursday, when we're going to spend a lot of time focusing on the issue of long-term debt and how best to reduce, if not eliminate it. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.